This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. It's not unusual for a company to ask employees in high-paid positions to sign non-compete agreements. It prohibits them from taking jobs with the company's competitor for a certain amount of time. But a recent New York Times article reports that non-compete agreements are becoming more common across the workforce. In many cases, blue-collar workers have limited bargaining power after signing a non-compete clause. Joining me now is Connor Doherty. He's a reporter for the New York Times who wrote the article. Welcome, Connor.
Thanks.
Give us a brief summary of a non-compete agreement. Expand the little bit that I've described in my introduction.
Well, it's basically an agreement inside of your employment contract, and it says, you know, for some amount of time after you leave the company, you won't go work for a competitor. It's usually a year or two, and it's usually some geographic radius that's, depending on the business. You know, if it's a big national business, it might be the whole U.S., and if it's like a local business, it might be, a couple miles within their location.
And they, as I suggested, were not unusual in certain kind of high-profile industries or for high-paying jobs. Tell us where they are most common and the rationale behind them.
I think it's most common around technical employees. There's some research on that. So that's obviously executives and people like that, but also, sort of scientist types that are, very familiar with patents and that sort of thing. And, that's where it started, and it's kind of seems to have morphed from there.
So if you work for a pharmaceutical company and you've got some trade secrets that you've been working on at one company and suddenly you become a very valuable asset to the other company, they might be worth, you might be worth a lot more to that company and bring your trade secrets with you. That's
yes,
what we're trying
and
to
I
protect
think,
ourselves.
Yeah, and you asked about the logic. I think the logic here is that, so here's the argument against non-competes is that there's like a million ways to sue somebody for stealing a trade secret. Or a non-disclosure or whatever. And if you were to talk to an executive in favor of these, they would say, yeah, that's true, but how am I ever going to know that somebody stole my trade secret until it's too late? At which point, yeah, sure, I can sue them, but at that point, there's no point. So if I use a non-compete, I can just sort of prevent them from going in the first place.
All right. So they, as I say, they're somewhat common. They're debatable and about how necessary they are. But at that high end, those kinds of highly technical jobs, you're saying they are becoming more common at lower paying jobs and even in blue collar work. Tell us about that.
So what? Yeah, it's kind of hard to track exactly, but it looks like what happened is over the past, decade or 15 years, they started moving down to like salespeople, executive recruiters, people who had a lot of client, contact. And then now you're seeing them everywhere with blue-collar jobs, people who work on pumps, shovel dirt even, people who work in factories, people who, there was a somewhat notorious case recently where Jimmy John's sandwiches, the fast food sub-sandwich chain, made sandwich makers signed non-compete agreements that said they like couldn't go work at Subway or something like that. And so they're, I think once you start seeing these things in fast food, we've really gone all the way down to the lowest possible job.
Well, your piece features a story of a North Carolina worker named Keith Bollinger. Tell us his story.
So Keith is a factory manager in Hickory, North Carolina, and he worked at this factory for 20-something years, even longer if you start looking at the different ownerships, and he was a quality control manager. So what they do is they bring fabric in, and then they treat it with chemicals and make a fire retardant and stuff like that, and he helped manage this process. But he was not a chemist who might invent, some of these compounds. He just sort of managed the application of these things. And he took a job. After the recession, there was a lot of layoffs. His pay went down. He got, as the recovery started, he got an offer with another company for a significant raise, $14,000, and he took it, and the company sued him. They went back and forth in court for 3.5 years. Him and his wife fought it. They borrowed a ton of money. They, drained their savings, and it ended 2 weeks ago, a week and a half ago, about 10 days ago, what happened was, it gets sort of complicated, but basically the company, somebody had to pay the company $200,000. There were multiple plaintiffs at this point. Again, it gets complicated, so I don't think he had to pay that himself. But, you know, ultimately, hundreds of thousands of dollars, once you add in the legal fees, were spent trying to keep this guy from taking a $14,000 raise with a competitor.
What about the legality of these agreements themselves? I mean, has there ever been a challenge to a non-compete agreement at any level, at the state level or at the national level?
I think they're challenged all the time, and they are often overturned all the time. For instance, judges can say, you know, this is unreasonable. In fact, okay, so just to use Keith's example, Keith was sued for leaving his company for another company. And what they do in the law, they call it an injunction, which basically just means they sue to say the guy has to leave his job. And the first judge in the North Carolina Superior Court said, this is too much. Basically, this agreement was written too broadly. And he said, you know, I'm not going to do this. But then the other company appealed it, and it went to the appeals court, and they eventually overturned it. So there are, you know, case-by-case basis challenges all the time. But I don't think that there has been, to my knowledge, I might be wrong about this, but a big, important challenge to the concept of these. I think it's a state-by-state basis, for what it's worth. North Carolina is about middle of the road. But some states enforce these very, you know, their laws enforce these very strictly. And other states, we'll talk about this later, maybe, but is California, which does not allow non-competes. You can't, essentially, no employee can be made to sign a non-compete in the state at any level.
Well, I want to get to California. Yeah, that is a very interesting example.
North Carolina is right in the middle somewhere.
So what about, a defender of non-compete agreements, businesses that say we should have them, might argue, look, these people sign these things voluntarily. They can say no. And that's their choice, and therefore there's, you know, so don't sign it if you don't think this is a good deal for you. How much leverage does the average employee have in this case?
The average employee has very little leverage, for one. For two, the agreements are very often put in front. There's been multiple surveys about this. It's very rarely presented like this is your non-compete. It's usually just like, oh, here's an employment contract, sign it, and people sign it like they sign their cable bill. Maybe we shouldn't do that, but they do. And then the second thing is, a lot of times that's presented to you on your first day at work or after you've been at the company for a little while. In Keith's case, he signed the agreement in 2007, and he'd been there, you know, 20-something years at that point.
So there's not a lot of leverage going in. And then when you think about it, especially at these lower-paying jobs, you talk about a sandwich maker at Jimmy John's, if I sign a non-compete agreement, the company could decide to abuse that and ask me to do things that are more and more difficult, less and less, perhaps even legal. And I realize that I can't even work somewhere else, at least not in this industry, because of that agreement I signed. I might have to accept some untoward working conditions because I don't have much choice having signed that.
Well, I think the other thing is, too, it's asking this bigger question. Yeah, everything you just said, and also it's this bigger question of, like, what's the line between the skills you picked up and the, like, knowledge you have about the company? Hmm. You know, the New York Times owns all the copyrights for all the stories I write. I do not own that work. Once I publish something, I can't go, like, publish a book and make money off of it myself, right? But I've learned, you know, writing skills, reporting skills, research skills. I can take those with me anywhere I want to do any kind of job where those sorts of skills are valued. So when a company, if I were to be made to sign a non-compete, they would essentially be putting some ownership over my skills.
Right.
And so it's this question of, like, well, what are the things you own in terms of, like, work you put in to, like, learn a particular trade? And what's the difference between
right.
that and things a company really owns?
Well, and like this gets to the state of California, which has outlawed these things, and that is really counterintuitive when you think of the impact on Silicon Valley. But tell us that story quickly.
Okay, so California has basically a blanket prohibition on non-compete clauses. And this was not passed it's like a relic of state law that's been there forever. But what's important is that the judges there have interpreted it to be a blanket prohibition on non-competes. And a lot, not only is this, counterintuitive to what you'd think in a highly technical place, but a lot of people think, and there's a lot of research on this, that this is actually one of the reasons the Silicon Valley developed in California. And it's just one of the truisms of the economy that what's good for the overall economy is very often not good for any individual company. And what this prohibition on non-competes does is, so you could argue that the Silicon Valley was basically founded when this company, they invented the transistor in Bell Labs in New York. A bunch of people moved out to California to try to make some companies around it. And a group called the Traitorous Eight left a company called Shockley Semiconductor to start Fairchild Semiconductor, which ultimately then morphed into a company called Intel. So these people were all defecting constantly to try to go across the street and do the exact same thing. And from the very beginning of the Silicon Valley, there's this pattern of people just bailing, you know, just like, screw it, I'm going to leave and start my own company.
So actually, in the industry, and I do have to go right now, Connor, and I appreciate your time, but in the industry that company by company could have used this the most, actually, that's where you don't have it. There's a blanket prohibition, and ironically, that's what leads to the development of the business, because there is this kind of pirating and easy transfer. So on a business and statewide basis, better for the state, not so good for Apple and Intel individually.
Yes, and it's... And also, what it does is it really increases the pace of innovation, because an innovation is only special for so long. And it just absolutely heightens the bar, and it makes everyone work harder and innovate that much harder. And so it just increases the velocity.
Connor Daugherty, a reporter for the New York Times, recently wrote a piece on how non-compete agreements keep workers locked into jobs. Thank you, Connor.
Thank you.
You can find a link to his reporting at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer and Sovietologist William Taubman tells us what's up with Russia. Stay tuned.